Good morning, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. And I tell you honestly, my heart is full this morning. It happens to me often just before I'm introduced. The good news for you is I forget everything I think is important to tell you this morning. I don't know what will happen for the next hour. I've got three or four stories that I usually tell, and what fills in between them, you know, I might accidentally say something I need to hear. And my sponsor has told me that speaker meetings are often for the speaker, and that your opportunity is to be patient, tolerant, allow me the chance to babble on about what perhaps I need to babble on about. I'm not confused about the fact that you need to hear what I have to say this morning. I just have an overwhelming need to say it. And I'll put on a suit and travel hundreds or thousands of miles for that opportunity. I told Bob my home group is meeting this morning. Actually, right now they meet at 10:30 on Saturday and Sunday mornings, 9 a.m. for a book study and 10:30 for open discussion meeting, and they are all quite glad that I'm here with you. I want to thank Nancy, the committee, Doug, James for being such a great host this weekend, all of you for making me feel so comfortable and so at home. It's been my experience that at these conferences or any time that we gather, that the speakers, Al-Anon and AA speakers, have been terrific. But it's my theory that we merely serve as a framework so the weekend can take place. So the magic that happens between these meetings, that was in the hospitality suites, and as you went out to dinner, and when I sat at dinner last night with the James and Andy and Steve, when I had breakfast with Bob this morning, when I had breakfast the other morning with Mari and Joyce and Mary, when I got a chance to visit with Ellen and Rick and Lisa and everyone that's been here, that's the blessing that I get by being invited to an event like this, that I get to meet people, I get to fellowship, I get to talk with people who challenge me to take a closer look at myself and my recovery and stand in front of the man that I am today and see what I can do, how I can continue to grow. Someone asked me if I get nervous before I talk, and it's not nervous. You know, I used to get nervous. I used to worry what you thought about my talk, and that may well happen. I'm not above self-consciousness from time to time, but I was driving home one night. I'd spoken at a little group meeting in Richmond, Virginia. I was about 3 or 4 years sober, and I had just stumbled and bumbled my way all the way through this talk, and I was so embarrassed, and I called my sponsor, Joe, and I said, "Joe, you know, I don't think I did a very good job tonight." And he said, "Well, Steve, you're starting with a false premise." He says, "Because that implies there's a night you think you did do a good job." And he reminded me that my opportunity, my privilege, is to come here and do what I was invited to do at the best of my ability at that given moment, and to not judge whether I did a good job or a bad job. So that's what I'll try to do this morning. I also had then spoken maybe a year later at a speaker meeting there in Richmond that was kind of the big speaker meeting in town and a couple of hundred people. And I was quite nervous. And I was talking to Joe before that meeting, and I said, "Joe, I've never spoken before a crowd this large." And he said, "Steve, don't worry, pal." He said, "By the time you're done, it'll be down to the size you're used to." You know, more of you will have to leave today for that to happen, but I don't put it out of the realm of possibility. My sobriety date's June 30th, 1989, and my home group is the backroom group. Thank you. I'm pleased about that as well, but I am reminded every year when it's time to pick up a medallion that my sponsor says that is a measurement of time between my last drink and today. But it does not on any given day measure my spiritual growth or where I am in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous Beyond Dry. And so frankly, while I've not had a drink from that day till this, I do know that on the spiritual level, I can be all over the board. It's not a steady climb up. There are plateaus. I have a dip. As I told Bob at breakfast this morning, I'm capable of anything I have ever done again. And sometimes I'm disappointed how often that shows up. You know, I told you June 30th is my sobriety date, which means that I will now tell you about June the 29th, which was my last drink. And it's often, you know, one of the great things in Alcoholics Anonymous, the primary components of Alcoholics Anonymous is our identification, one alcoholic with another. And this is often where I lose people, because my last drink was an Amaretto on the rocks. And I am properly embarrassed by that. But now I hope you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I didn't know that was going to be my last drink when I took it. I would not have gone down that way. You know, been a little meeting, said, "Steve, you can have one more drink, pal. What will it be?" And as I considered all the possibilities, I don't think Amaretto's what I would have come up with, you know. I would have been sucking off the neck of a vodka bottle. But I had no idea that was going to be my last drink. But I was scheduled to go into a treatment facility on July the 1st of 1989. Not because I had had some epiphany, not because I had decided that my life required some moral uplift or that I needed to stop drinking, but I was just going to fulfill my obligation to the legal system of Williamson County, Tennessee. I had been convicted of my sixth DUI a few months before. They had given me some jail time associated with that, and they had offered me, as part of the plea agreement, to go to jail for 60 days or take 10 weekends in jail and go to residential treatment. And they both seemed untenable options for a guy like me, but it was really a math problem for me. One was 48 days and one was 60 days. And to be honest, if treatment had been 60 days and jail had been 48, I would have opted for the jail for 48. But as it was, they gave me a year of probation to complete this treatment. I did not stop. I left the courthouse that day after doing that plea agreement. I'm walking down the steps, and, you know, most of what I know about my alcoholism or think I know about it, I know looking back at the rearview mirror. I didn't see it as it was happening, certainly in the way that I see it now. And, you know, we tell our stories, and some people would suggest that the what it was like now portion of our stories doesn't change. But I will tell you that mine does, because my view of it changes. What I used to be like changes as I grow and look back at it with more clarity and can see what I couldn't see before. And notice how my alcoholism was alive in my life before I even had a clue. Now, I knew that drinking caused me a lot of problems. I knew I drank and things happened. That's what the big book says, right? The alcoholic drinks, something happens. And I've always said, and no one has really asked for me to make any particular changes to the big book, but should I be asked one day, it would not be the words, but it would be the punctuation. And I think that sentence should end in an exclamation point rather than a period. Because when I drink, something happens. Something big happens. Something dramatic happens. And it's not always in the external things. Often it's the internal view of the way that I now view and see the world after having a drink. And sometimes it blows up and gets all over the people around me in a way that's not too pretty. But I was walking down the courthouse steps. They had given me this year of probation. They had made clear to me that if I was arrested for another alcohol-related offense between that day and the end of that probation, that I would go directly to jail for a year. There is nothing that frightened me more than the prospect of going to jail. I am not a go-to-jail guy. I'm about as plain vanilla, middle-class alcoholic as you will ever run across. I don't know how I get places like this talking to people like you, because I don't have a dramatic drunkologue. And I don't have a lot of drama in my story of recovery. What is miraculous to me is the effect of my recovery on me from the inside out. What's dramatic is my life viewing it from the inside out today with this recovery and Alcoholics Anonymous a part of it. The way that I can see, the way that I feel. In fact, that definition, one of the descriptions, if you will, of spiritual experience in the 12 and 12, says that all the genuine ones, they may look and sound different on all of us, but the genuine ones have three things in common: that we can do, feel, and believe that which we could not do, feel, or believe on our unaided will and resources alone. And I find as I sit here today, stand here today, that I can do, feel, and believe things that were beyond my reach before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is a difference in the way that I perceive the world. It's a difference in the way that I experience the world. And it's a difference in the way that I view myself. But as I'm walking down the courthouse steps, I made a decision not to drink. And I was fully committed to that decision. And the decision was to avoid the consequences of drinking. I will not drink for the year of this probation because I do not want to go to jail. Now, I often say that I just parked my car too far from the courthouse because as I continued to walk to my car, my plan took on a revision. I thought about it a little bit and I said, you know, my problem really is drinking and driving. That's what got me sent to jail. Wasn't the drinking, it was the driving part after. So I will not drink and drive during the year of this probation. And you can bet your firstborn on that, I'm absolutely committed to this decision. But it wasn't to my car yet. And I walked just a little further and my plan took on yet another revision. And it was, I won't drink much when I drive. Which was pretty much the plan I left home with the night that I got that last DUI. But see, it didn't. It sounds absurd as I stand here and say it this morning. And you laugh and I laugh because we get it. Because we identify with that. But that day, that didn't seem like crazy thinking. That seemed like just a progression. This was just linear analytical thinking that helped me arrive at the new plan that I won't drink much when I drive. And by the way, a lot of people had suggested to me to just not drink much when I drive. It seems a reasonable approach to the non-alcoholic. But what sets me apart, you know, as I sit here and think about the speakers we've had this weekend and the different folks I've met here, and if you look at, you know, almost 8,000 people at this roundup, that we show up, a lot of us look different from each other. We come from a variety of different backgrounds, social, financial, racial, cultural, educational, religious, and alcohol affects many of us differently. Alcoholism looks different on different people. Some of us drink and pull the blinds and lock the door and turn the lights down and drink alone. Some of us drink and want to dance. Some of us drink and want to fight. Some of us drink and, you know, get in the car and go somewhere. And we do those things, but we all gather here today on the common ground of alcoholism and what is described in the doctor's opinion, that phenomenon of craving. While in the doctor's opinion, he describes a variety of different types of alcoholics. He talks about the psychopath. He talks about the guy that after not drinking for a while thinks maybe he can take a drink. He talks about the manic depressive, who is even perhaps the most difficult to understand at that time. And he talks about the guy that might be alike in every other respect except when he drinks. And he says all of these and many more, which implies to me that that's just a short list of the broad types of descriptions of people who are in this room. All of us share one common denominator if we plead guilty to the charge of alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is that we suffer the phenomenon of craving when we drink, the allergic reaction to alcohol that Silkworth says sets us apart as a distinct entity. That's the common ground from which I begin my journey to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, is a surrender to that particular part of the problem. And then I began to get in touch with the fact of the unmanageability of my life, which in the first step is suggest that I'm powerless over alcohol, and I got that one first. The unmanageability was harder for me to grab hold of. You know, it doesn't say that my life is unmanageable because I drink. That's a hyphenated statement which seems to imply two equal but separate ideas. And I also, for me, don't think the unmanageability of my life was defined by the fact that I drank and got sent to jail, or that I often ended up at the wrong place with the wrong people, or that I wasn't the father that I wanted to be and needed to be, and I wasn't the husband that I wanted to be and needed to be, or that there was financial ruin in my home because of my behavior. That's the chaos of my alcoholism. The unmanageability was the fact that under no set of circumstances could I end up being okay inside. When things were good, when things were bad. I don't believe conditions caused my alcoholism. I don't think conditions cure my alcoholism. But that morning, I was just headed to the car with a new plan not to drink much when I drive. I drank for the full year of that. I tried to not drink much when I drive. I took that deal, you know, the version that is in our book of all the different things that we try to do not to drink or to drink successfully. And I don't remember the exact deal, but you know there was a weight to alcohol quotient that you could have in a time. If you weigh this much, you can have this much alcohol in this amount of time. And I just report to you that never has time passed so slowly. I'm sitting at the bar literally watching the clock, and pretty soon I'm into next Thursday's quota, you know. And so by the time I leave at midnight, I can't drink for another month and a half just to even this thing out. But really what happened somewhere during that night is I thought I changed my mind about not drinking. It felt like I changed my mind and said, wait a minute, Steve, you're overreacting. You're overreacting. June the 29th, I went out with my wife and with three other couples before I was going to go away to this treatment facility. On June the 30th, my wife Connie and I spent the day with my then five-year-old daughter Abby before Daddy was going away on a 28-day business trip. And we went to Chuck E. Cheese to spend the day together, and I stop and make a public service announcement here. If you're here tonight or today and you have not stopped drinking yet, do not spend your first day sober at Chuck E. Cheese, okay? It is some kind of loud in there, I am telling you. I called my wife and daughter before I came down. You know, I got a wonderful marriage today as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're on their way driving back from Richmond, Virginia to Nashville, where they'd been over for a wedding this week. And, I told Connie, I said, say a little prayer for me. And I want to check my watch here. I said, about 11:30, she's on Eastern time where they're driving. I said, about 11:30 your time, I'm going to tell all of them there that I have 10 days seniority on you and our recovery. And I do, her sobriety date is 10 days after mine. And it's very important 10 days to me. And I tell her all the time when we see something a little differently or when we're about to have an argument, I say, just wait 10 days, baby. It's all coming clear to you. I came home about 8-9 months ago, and she knows I tell this, and she really is not real fond of this particular story. But I came home late one night, getting back from a conference, and I'm slipping into bed, and she's in there, and she said, "How'd it go?" I said, "Well, I had a great time." And she said, "You didn't tell them that 10-day story, did you?" And I said, "Oh, baby, they love it." And she said, "I just hate that." I said, "I know, but in 10 days you won't." And you know, the fact is, she's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't have to leave my house to find the example that I'd like to emulate in my daily living. I'll head out of the house on a Monday evening, going to a meeting, and four of the women that she sponsors will be coming over while they're going through. For the 10 years that we've lived back in Nashville, she has usually two nights a week had groups of women that she goes through the book with on a regular basis. Her sobriety date is 10 days after mine, but it was 3.5 years from her last drink till she came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a story that she has to tell. But, boy, that takes a tremendous amount of willpower not to drink with the amount of anger and pain and hurt that goes with untreated alcoholism. But that particular day, as I'm now on Saturday, July the 1st of 1989, my buddy Ricky comes by to pick me up to take me to treatment. That particular day, my wife gave me the kind of support that I don't hear a lot of spouses give in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I'm getting in the van to go off to treatment, she says, "Honey, no matter what, don't stop drinking." Now, you just don't get that kind of rock-solid support from a lot of folks. And I had no intent. Don't worry, baby, I'm in, you know. So my buddy Ricky's driving me over there. And you know, about three months ago, I took my friend Ricky to his first ever AA meeting. And I don't know if he's an alcoholic, and he doesn't think so, but we were really trying to get him to an Al-Anon meeting. He's got some alcoholism is having a real impact on his life. And we couldn't get to that to the Al-Anon meeting, so he went to the open AA meeting with me. We went to lunch later, and he was just fascinated, and he was moved by what happened there. So I'm not sure what the future holds, but he said, "Steve, I'd love, you know," he said, "that was great." He said, "but I just don't think I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "Well, Ricky, you know, why don't you go to Al-Anon?" I said, "It'll be great for you, man, because if you're not alcoholic, you can drink and get these 12 steps." And you know, I mean, what an attractive package that is, right? And but we'll see where that goes. Another one of the women that was at dinner with us that night, just about a year and a half ago, she called our house one night and she said, "I need some help." She said, "I'm drinking in the morning. I can't get to work." She came over and stayed a few days at the house with us. Her husband's a great friend of ours, but we hadn't socialized with him much in the years. Now she had a change of heart, like me. She overreacted, and she is pulling back to take a look. And you know what? I think that's perfectly okay. You know, I hope that we got to know where alcohol. It seems to me that I wasn't anxious for recovery until I was convinced I had the problem. So the hopeless nature of my condition was brought home to me. And without that hope on my own, then I became open to the prospect that there was hope here at Alcoholics Anonymous. I pulled up at that treatment facility. My buddy Ricky let me out. On the way, he said, "Steve, what do you think this is going to be like?" And I said, "Man, I don't have a clue. I don't have any idea." I said, "But I'll tell you one thing. All I knew about, what I thought I knew about AA was, you know, maybe on a bad TV movie of the week." And I said, "But I'm not going to get in some little circle and go, 'I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic,' and whine about the most intimate details of my life." And about 3 weeks later, I was just telling people more than they wanted to know about me. I'll be honest with you. And I started making stuff up. And because, you know, you get there, I'm the type of guy that will minimize and minimize and minimize my drinking and my effects and harm on other people right up until I get to AA, and then I start exaggerating about my drinking and what I had done, because right out of the gate, I want some AA street cred, you know. I want to be an AA bad boy, and I'm just not. I'm just a middle-class weenie of a guy that ended up at Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got there, they did what happens a lot of places. They gave me a test. They called it an assessment. It felt like a test. It made me sweat like a test. It had questions that were hard to answer like a test. The questions, there were 30 of them at this particular place, and they all began with my, as I look back now, I know that the reason they call it an assessment was it was their attempt to assess if I was or was not an alcoholic, and for them, if I was, at what degree? And because if you answered yes to 3 of these questions, you were a problem drinker; 4, probably alcoholic; 5, chronic alcoholic. I didn't know what chronic meant. It sounded like a promotion from regular alcoholic, though. Every question began with the words, "Have you ever?" She said, "That means even once, and even with a really good reason." Have you ever had a DUI? Have you ever had a blackout? Have you ever had a problem at work because of drinking? Have you ever had a problem at home because of drinking? Have you ever drank alone? Have you ever drank in the morning? On and on and on with these "have you ever" questions, with just a little box to check yes or no to what are obviously essay questions. Okay. You know what I mean. These require some explanation. These are not simple yes and no questions. Have you ever drank alone? Well, yes, but they left. And had they told me where they were going, I would have gone with them. The most difficult one for me, I think, was, have you ever drank in the morning? Now, how fine a line are we going to cut on that one? Because I'm asking, well, like, what do you mean? I mean, is the sun up, or are you talking 12:01 a.m.? I mean, if I stayed up a little late, is that drinking in the morning? You know, Steve, just check yes or no. If I check yes to drink in the morning, you're going to think I'm like the guy who has to reach over and grab a little brown whiskey to get his heart started in the morning off the nightstand. And no, I'm just a guy that drank through the night. And you might even room me with this guy, you know. And this was my fear. Because, see, I'm still trying desperately to rationalize my drinking, my behavior. There's a line back in one of the personal stories, the story Freedom from Bondage, where a lady talks about the fact that that she describes rationalization as giving a socially acceptable explanation for socially unacceptable behavior. And a few years ago when I really saw that, I realized that that's what I had been doing that morning, taking that assessment. That's what I had been doing most of my life, is trying to provide an explanation for behavior. Now, the explanation was never really the motivation for what I had done. I would do something and then try to find an explanation that would explain it. One, for years, that I thought one that would explain me to you. But upon closer examination, I discovered that I needed an explanation that would explain me to me. That would let me off the hook for becoming the man and doing the things that I had begun to do. Help me find an explanation that will let me live with me doing these things. And it got harder and harder and harder. There were 30 questions on that test, like I told you. I looked at it a few years later. I got out of, I got my file from treatment to get some insurance, and that took 10 years. But I looked at it, and I see that I'd answered yes to 10 of the questions in the affirmative, so I'm in the chronic area now, but I realized I had lied on 10 others. And misunderstood a host of others, and the only one I said no, I answered honestly for sure and for certain is I never drank while pregnant. And I say, and I proudly say not even once, and not even with a really good reason. Okay, but I will tell you, I know today that the way that I answered those questions is not what makes me an alcoholic. The men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous helped me come to the concession and conclusion about alcoholism for me. The way I answered those questions are evidence of my alcoholism. They are the results of my alcoholism. They might expose my alcoholism, but they are not the description of my alcoholism, because I'm an alcoholic, I believe, because when I honestly want to, I can't seem to stop drinking entirely. And when drinking, I have little control over the amount I take. I am unpredictable. I am subject to the phenomenon of craving, the allergy to alcohol that may or may not kick in on a given night. The, the, The puzzling thing to me early on was finding those times when I seemingly drank successfully and seemingly had the willpower to start and stop at my discretion. There were times that I would go to the bar, be with people, and say, I'll be home at 8. Mine was never about how much I would drink, but, you know, it was kind of a timing thing. I'll be home at 8, and I got home at 8. Or I've got a big day at work tomorrow, and maybe I show up, and so I go home and get the rest or do the work I need to do or show up at my daughter's play or softball game or whatever it might be. But the next time, with reasons just as good and equally committed, I'm off to the races and don't make it. I am unpredictable. I'm going to go back now and tell you a little bit about my first drink, which is equally embarrassing. I didn't drink till I was 19 years old. I was a freshman in college at Middle Tennessee State University. I'd grown up in Smyrna, Tennessee, a small town just about 30 miles out of Nashville. At the time, it had about 5,000 people in it. Middle-class family. I got a brother. I got two sisters. My mom and dad were there. Nobody was hitting anybody. Nobody was screaming and yelling. There was certainly drinking going on in my house, but it didn't have an undue influence on me that I could tell. It's not something that I was conscious of or paying much attention to. I had no circumstantial reason to become an alcoholic. I feel like I hear other people talk about feeling, but I don't even know how to differentiate me from the other guys in the neighborhood. You know, I don't know the difference between how the alcoholic feels and the non-alcoholic feels when I was 12 years old, because I know lots of folks who were insecure, who were, you know, that inward malady, how does it show up? I'm not always sure. I know when I took a drink, it seemed to affect me differently than it did the non-alcoholic. It seemed to treat those symptoms in me differently than it did the non-alcoholic. But it seems like one of the things that binds us all together is one of the things that makes us all alike is we all think we're different. I think that I'm feeling something in a way that you don't feel it, or I'm seeing it in a way that you don't feel it. And it's usually not that I think it's a keen way. I think that it's in a burdensome way. It's in a burdensome way back then. But I had a pretty good, I was a good kid. I went where I said I was going. I was with who I said I was going to be with. And I came home when I said I was going to come home. And then these guys, and I made a decision not to drink. And I played athletics. I did things. So I just decided not to drink. I was just a good kid. And two buddies came over one night. We're headed back to a basketball game at my high school, which will give you some idea of my emotional maturity, that in college, we're going to go back to the high school because my best shot at impressing a young lady was going to be a sophomore in high school, maybe. Guys, hand back a bottle of Boone's Farm wine. Oh, you know, I hate it when you groan like that. I really do. You know, I know a lot of people at my age that got started on the Boone's Farm, and then you show up here and act like you're too good for it, and it really, yeah. Yeah. But the fact is, that thing, and I liked it because it was sweet, you know. It took me a while, frankly, to get a taste for alcohol. I enjoyed getting drunk right away. The drinking of the alcohol was hard for me for quite a while. But they passed that around. I took a few drinks, and I was in the back seat of a 1968 Volkswagen, and the experience I had for me, and I hear many people explain it different ways, but for me, all of a sudden, I could not wait to get where we were going, because I thought they couldn't wait to see me when we got there. And I didn't think I'd ever been that comfortable, that at ease, that self-confident, that free from the bondage of self that I was at that moment. And I couldn't wait to climb out of the back seat of that Volkswagen and spring myself on an unsuspecting world. And we went, and I had a wonderful time. You know, our big book talks about what most normal folks get from a few drinks. And I got to tell, you guys have read it back in A Vision for You, but it says for most normal folks, drinking means conviviality. For a while, I thought I'd just been arrested for solicitation of that, but I've actually looked it up since, and it means feasting and drinking, among other things. It says it means joyous intimacy with friends, colorful imagination, release from care, boredom, and worry, and a feeling that life is good. I just got thirsty saying that. That's an exciting package for me. That's an attractive package for me. And fortunately, the book goes on to explain what my experience was. Not so for those of us in the latter days of our drinking. Maybe momentarily. You know, for me, maybe between 9:30 and 11, I'm feeling those things. But then comes oblivion and awakening to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Oh, not again. Not again. Not in this jail again for DUI. Not handcuffed again. Not the wrong place with the wrong person again. Not letting my daughter down again. Not letting my wife down again. My brother, my mother, the people I work with, the people that love me the most. The despair, the bewilderment, the terror, the frustration that comes with that. The book says, unhappy drinkers who read this will understand. And when I read it, I understood it. Fortunately for me, that goes on to talk about that what Alcoholics Anonymous does for me is very similar to what some normal folks get from a few drinks. A page or two over, when it asks me, when I've decided to stop drinking, but I ask you guys, have you got a substitute for me? You know, I don't show up here willing to make, you know, I'll stop, but what are you offering? You know, what's the package you got? And what that book says and what my experience has been and what you shared with me in your own way when I got here was that, yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It's not just a substitute. It's not an even trade. It's vastly more. So it said, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll find a fellowship, which is a lot like joyous intimacy with friends. It says, my imagination will be fired, which is a lot like colorful imagination. It says, I'll find release from care, boredom, and worry, which is the exact same words that it used on the previous page. It said, my life will take on new meaning, and the most satisfactory years of my existence lie ahead. And I will tell you that that has been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. These are the most satisfying years of my existence. And I believe that is true because they are the most purposeful years of my existence. I have a reason to live today. I have a primary purpose, and I have adopted the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got up in the morning, my primary goal is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety and try to live my life in the process of that. I wake up sometimes with a host of good ideas. My sponsor encourages me to call him whenever I get a really good idea just to run it by him. Anyway, I got to tell you that you know, my drinking, I don't know if I was alcoholic the night just before I took that drink, or if I was alcoholic just after I took that drink, or if I was alcoholic some months after. What I know is that I don't know whether I drank alcoholically from that night on, but I drank enthusiastically from that night on. And our book says that that the guys believe that, since while they can't prove it, they believe that many of us, those first 100 that wrote the book, could have stopped drinking early in their drinking careers. So I don't know if I figured out the reason they can't prove it is they never tried it. And that's why I don't know whether I could have stopped or not, because I had absolutely no desire to stop. There was no attempt to stop at that point, and because I was getting exactly what I wanted from alcohol. And though there were dues to pay almost immediately, there were behavioral things and there were problems and there were car wrecks and there were arrests, it was small price to pay for what alcohol was giving me at the time. I'm going to tell you two quick drinking stories, and then I'm going to sober up. In 1977, I kind of ran away from home. I moved down to Fort Lauderdale. A guy gave me a job down there. Two men did, actually. Unfamiliar with my drinking history. I'd had two or three of these DUIs by now. Two of them. They gave me a company car. I'm over watching football one night, Monday night football, with a couple of buddies of mine. We're drinking pretty hard. We're accessorizing that with some other things. I jump in the car to head home at halftime of this game. I'm flying down this little residential street, and I don't navigate this horseshoe turn. And I hit this tree. And, man, I hit it hard. and it just rocked the tree and rocked the car, and it caved in the whole passenger side and broke out the front windshield and the back windshield, and ultimately it was deemed a total loss by the insurance company. But I wasn't hurt badly. I was shaken and stunned a little, but I'm thinking, man, what am I going to do? I can't afford to wait for the police to get here and get another DUI, and I'll lose this job and everything that comes with that type of deal. So remarkably, the car would drive, and I backed it away from the tree, and I tried to drive back over to my buddy's house where I'd been, and I mean, man, this car was, it would barely move, and it was shaking. The frame was bent so badly it was almost going sideways, you know, and people were looking at me. I said, God, just let me get back over to their house, you know, and I got over there so we could come up with a plan. So Larry, Curly, and Moe concocted this plan, and the plan was we will go back over there, they'll get in the car with me, we'll drive back over there, drive the car back into the tree. We'll nudge it back up against the tree. They will serve as witnesses and validate my story that a white Ford pickup truck had run me off the road causing this terrible accident. We drive over there, we do that. I'm walking up to the house that's at the corner lot to borrow the guy's phone to call the police. He came flying out of his house. He's running down there where we are. He said, are you guys okay? Are you okay? I said, yeah, pal, we're okay. He said, well, it's the damnedest thing. You're the second guy to hit that tree tonight. And I said, yeah, y'all ought to cut that damn tree down, man. It is poorly placed. And call the police. The police came. We gave them the story. They bought the story. To be honest with you, you know, as we do, we gave them such a high level of detail about this accident, about the truck, about a partial license plate, little information about the driver. And 3 or 4 days later, I'm getting a little resentment that they have not, you know, arrested somebody, because the truth is, when you give them that kind of information, they'll usually pull somebody in anyway, but that crime has gone unsolved to this day, as far as I know. Now, that's the absurdity of alcoholism, and I want to also stop and make something clear here, lest I forget. We are not going to have a gathering of people like we have here that somebody's life hasn't been inalterably changed by a drunk driver. And I don't want you to think for a minute that I take light the fact that I often got in that car and drove drunk. I did. And today, when I hear about those horrible accidents and people who were impacted, I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for the families and the people that were affected, the victims of that. But I also have a tremendous amount of empathy for the driver of the car. Because that's me. That is me. There's nothing that separates me from the man who's done that or the woman who's done that and caused that kind of harm but dumb luck, God's grace, or both. A couple of years later, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm at a TGI Fridays. I'm throwing back kamikaze shooters all day. I get in the car to leave. I end up getting on the interstate going the wrong way on I-285 in the perimeter of Atlanta. I hit a car going head-on, and two other cars hit us. It totaled all four cars, and I came to in the Fulton County Jail with just a fuzzy memory of what had happened. I had vomited on myself. I'd urinated on myself. Or, as I say, I hope I did, because somebody did. If you go down in the drunk tank, you know, the stains you wake up with may not be your own. But I prefer to think that I inflicted that indignity upon myself. But the fact is that that morning, and I tell you this in all sincerity, that morning I was as afraid as I had ever been at the circumstances I was in. I was as ashamed as I had ever been of what I had done. I was as humiliated as I had ever been of sitting there in my own urine and my own vomit. And I was as convinced as I had ever been that I would never drink again. I was fully committed to the prospect of not drinking. This was the line now that I would not cross again. And about 10 days later, I'm driving down the road, drinking a bottle of wine, smoking a joint, and saying, you know, I nearly overreacted to that. And I meant it. And I read in our book where it says there'll come a time that a guy like me won't be able to bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. I will be without defense against the first drink. I know today as I stand here that fear of consequences cannot keep me sober, that the love of my wife cannot keep me sober, that my desire to earn money and have a job will not keep me sober, that my desire for my daughter to love and respect me and for me to love her will not keep me sober. They can only serve to motivate me to want to do those things which will bring about and ensure my sobriety on a day-to-day basis through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They serve only as motivation, not as the source of my sobriety. I got out of that treatment center. I'd been in there, and two men came in. I'll tell you real quickly that I went down to Florida and I drove that car into that tree. About 2 months ago, the fellow who had hired me down there gave me a call. And, you know, I had made a kind of a halfway amend to him 12 or 15 years ago and really hadn't heard from him in between. He gave me a call. His son was in town and just needed some help on some business thing. This guy lives in Michigan up in Detroit, needed some help on a business thing. What a great opportunity to pay back just by helping his son and finally telling Jerry all the details of that story. I said, you didn't get from me as good as you gave. And is there something I can do, anything I can do to help you or help him, I will. I pop out of that treatment facility, and with my first AA meeting, two guys came in there on a Sunday night, my second night there. They did what I believe the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous are encouraged to do, what our book says. They showed up properly armed with the facts about themselves. I'd been all day in that treatment center where people were properly armed with the facts about me. And they were right about the facts about me, by the way, but I could not listen to them because I was defending myself from the charges. But these guys came in and they talked about their alcoholism, about their recovery. And nothing, you know, I didn't have any, you know, they didn't leave and me say, oh, well, let go and let God, or I didn't take the altar call to AA, and I didn't make a decision to stop drinking forever. I'll tell you what happened is when they left, I felt better from them having been there. And I think what they shared with us that night was the message of recovery. And our book says that message must have weight and depth. And if it has weight and depth, it can hardly miss the target of the real alcoholic. What they shared that night wasn't on an intellectual level. It was less about the stories they told. But the message itself, the spiritual element of that message, nudged something in me that created a spark that allowed what might happen next to happen and what might happen next to happen. And I was so glad. I was just a Monday of last week. One of those two men was sitting in a meeting with me, and I thanked him again. I thank him every time I see him for coming by there and being willing to share his recovery with me as we are this weekend with each other. I popped out of that treatment facility. I had decided I wanted to be sober. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was really going to require of me to be sober, but I was immediately attracted to the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, to what I was seeing in that recovery. I walked up the stairs of a treatment facility there of a clubhouse there in Nashville called the Friendship House. Be any two or three meetings going on at any one time, I turned to my left and I wandered into a little room where there was a book study going on. I didn't know from a book study, but there they were, about 12 or 13 people. And I got to tell you, those people changed my life. They changed my life because they shared with me. I wandered in there and sat down, and they didn't beat me with that book, and they didn't thump me with that book. What they did was shared with me. They had a reverence and a respect for the integrity of the message that was contained in that book. They shared their experience with it. We would read it. We would talk about it. They would suggest, as Bob said last night, here, this looks like a direction. This looks like a suggested action. We are only going to get so much relief in this room sitting here talking about it. How do I put what's here into application in my daily living? How do I take this and go take the action that's called for rather than the theorizing and the intellectual discussion, which is stimulating still to me. I love the discussion of the steps, often at the expense of doing them, you know, but it's an interesting give and take that we have with one another. My first sponsor, Frank, happened to be in that meeting. Frank, I talked to yesterday. He's laid up right now in a physical rehabilitation center. He's 83. He broke his hip about a month ago. The day that he broke his hip, I went and visited him at the. He and his wife Yo were at the emergency room. They had taken him in and put him in a holding room, but they had not yet gotten him to a hospital room. And he was in great pain, and he had really banged himself up where he fell outside, and they were giving him a lot of painkillers. But the doctor said, "There's no way that we can't give him enough painkiller to relieve the pain that he's got here." And he was frail, and he was hurting, and he was moaning. And I wandered over there, and I said, "Frank, how are you doing?" And he's really a tough old bird. And he says, "I'm not doing worth a damn." But he said, "Nothing to drink would make better." And that's his refrain. His two refrains are, "There's nothing to drink will make better, and it ain't them." I said, "Frank, it is often cleverly disguised as them. It often looks like them. It often appears to be them. It often seems like if they would act differently, do differently, that I would be better off. But the good news is it ain't them. The good news is that my problems are of my own making. The good news is that my welfare, my sobriety, my peace of mind is not dependent upon you. I love it when you cooperate, believe me. I really do. But it is not dependent on that." At a year sober, I moved to Richmond, Virginia, and I got another sponsor over there, a gentleman named Joe. Joe's been a treasure in my life, and I call him every Monday. You know, but what Joe does for me, and I was telling Bob this morning, my sponsors have never been guys that gave me permission or told me I can't do anything. They're guys that offer me perspective based on their experience, a sounding board for my ideas, a different way to look at things, a different way to approach something. And then, Steve, you're grown up, you've got to make your own choices. I called Joe about 2 years ago. We were moving into a new office building. My brother and I and another guy we work with, we had bought a little office building. We were moving our offices. We were furnishing it. We got together and we said, "Hey, you know what? This would be a great time to buy some furniture for our homes. Maybe this is when that plasma TV will go up over at the Lee household, and we'll run it through this bill of everything that we're buying at the company, and we will, you know, get the tax benefits of this." And I'm on board, man. This is sounding good. But I called Joe. I'm just talking to him about it, and I said, "Joe, what do you think?" And he said, "Steve, I don't think I would do it." And he says, "It feels a little too premeditated to me." And I said, "Well, you know, Joe, I know it sounds a little bit like tax fraud." He said, "No, Steve." He said, "Steve, let's be clear. It is tax fraud. But you do what you want to do." But the point is that the primary, what I see today as the primary value he offers me is helps me see the truth. You know, when I stand up here at the podium, I make a commitment to be honest with you. But I'm not always accurate. I've made a lot of honest mistakes in my day because I could not see the truth. Alcoholics Anonymous helps me see things as they really are and make my life decisions based on those things. I left a meeting one night after talking at great length. It wasn't a speaker meeting until I started speaking. I pontificated to the benefit of all, I was quite sure. And then I'm driving home, and I began to wonder about that, and I called Joe. He was at the meeting, and I said, "Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting?" And he said, "Oh, Steve, you're still asking all the wrong questions." He says, "Because, see, you're worried if you sounded self-righteous, and the question is, were you self-righteous?" He says, "Because truly, you don't care if you were self-righteous. You wonder if they caught you." You are afraid that they are driving home saying, "Man, that Steve is really a self-righteous son of a gun." And he's right. See, so much of my time before I got sober and since has been invested in what I think you think about me. The good news that has been shared with me is that I'm not who I think I am, and I'm not who you think I am. We are all wrong about me. Which should let all of us spend a much, much less time thinking about me. That will be easier for you than me, but we'll both work in that direction. But what a tremendous, you know, there's the line in the book, and it describes me so clearly when it talks about the fact that more than most, the alcoholic wears two faces, and he's an actor. and that it's his stage character that he wants his fellows to see, that he wants to be a man of certain reputation, but in his heart he knows he doesn't deserve it. How much time have I invested and spent in trying to win your approval in some way? And even when seemingly gaining it, even when getting that compliment, that pat on the back, that attaboy, that good job, leaving empty because I know you responded to the act, to the actor, believing I don't deserve it, getting nothing from it. Boy, what an exhausting life it is being the dancing bear for the rest of the world, trying to act my way through this life. Bill says someplace else that we're like actors in a play who've forgotten our lines. Oh, man, that's hard, isn't it? To improvise life, to think that you know exactly where you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to do, and I am just trying with everything I've got to anticipate and guess my next line and give the one, not the one that's authentic that comes from me, but the one that I think will serve the purpose of making you approve of, like me, have an opinion of me, maybe even make you mad at me, but to elicit whatever reaction I think is necessary. But what about the real authentic me? How do I find who I am? How do I find my voice? How do I have the humility to be who I am right now? Warts and all. I'm going to start winding down with the other thing. You know, our book suggests that when I stand up here, one of the things I do, and was mentioned last night, I think, or yesterday, is tell you what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today. And as Bob and I had breakfast this morning, and I just so appreciated the time that we had together. But one of the things I know is that the easiest thing I do is stand up here and tell you what I used to be like. The driving my car into a tree in 1977 is easy to tell. But what am I like today? Who's the man that stands before you today? What are the shortcomings? Am I willing to take a real honest look at me today? Do I have enough humility to recognize the growth that's still necessary? And enough humility not to think poorly of myself because of that? My sponsor suggested to me that when we got to step 6 and 7, that not to be confused, this is not where you're going to get perfect, Steve. He said it's where you're going to find the humility to be who you are right now. And as our book describes, one of the descriptions of humility in the 12 and 12 is a clear look at who and what I am right now, coupled with a sincere desire to be what I could be, what God would have me be. It seems the only way that I can be comfortable with this unfinished, imperfect package that's here today is if I am trying to be what God would have me be. See, I'm not willing to wait until I'm perfect to have a good day. I don't know about you. I spent most of my life in preparation for a good day, getting ready to have one. Got close once in 86, you know, could see it. Had about two things that were missing. If I could get them in, now we'll have a good day. We talk about living the day at a time, and today is the day. Today is the day that I've got to find a way to be comfortable in this package as it is and go forward with still a desire to, as it says in How It Works, and be willing to grow along spiritual lines. That's the point, that I'm still willing to grow along spiritual lines. So after telling you those things about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today to some extent, the book also says in another place that in our personal stories, each of us in our own language and from our own point of view, talks about how we established a relationship with God. The good news for me is the book goes on to say a couple other places that there may be a wide variation the way each of us approaches and conceives of that power. It doesn't have to sound alike. Our stories can be differently. None of that bothers me anymore, but when I showed up here, I was very uncomfortable with all of these spiritual terms. God, prayer, spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, all of those things made me uncomfortable. I don't think I was atheist or agnostic. I think I had been apathetic. I think I had not paid any attention to any of that for a long, long time. Now I showed up, and on page 44, after that definition or description of alcoholism that I confessed to and conceded to my innermost self that I can't stop entirely, and when I drink, I can't control how much I take, and the book says, well, then you're probably alcoholic, and if so, you're suffering from a disease which only a spiritual experience can conquer. I wasn't sure I wanted to have a spiritual experience, but I was pretty sure that it was unavailable to me. When I was in that treatment facility and at the end of AA meetings we would go out to, as we have done here this weekend, people would stand up and hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. And I would step back away from the circle. And I would put my hands behind my back and I would stare at the ceiling and some look at me defiance. I don't know what it was, but I wouldn't pray. And one of the guys came up to me one day and said, Steve, what's that all about? And with all honesty, I was telling him, I said, Mike, I don't know what I believe. I don't feel any particular belief. And I don't want to be a hypocrite. And he laughed like you did. And he said, Steve, he gave me that AA laugh. And you know, they say we're not laughing. Somebody else mentioned it the other night. But I showed up. People said, Steve, we're not laughing at you. We're laughing with you. But later, I think they were laughing at me. And some of them were laughing at me. And but he said, Steve, he said, I got good news for you and I got bad news for you. And I was feeling condescended to. I don't know if you felt condescended to a little bit. He really wasn't doing it, but I felt I'm getting the pat on the head. You know, Steve, I got good news and I got bad news. And I said, well, Mike, I'll play. What is it, man? He said, I said, what's the bad news? He said, well, the bad news is that hypocrisy is way down your list of problems. And he said, you might ought to address them in the order in which they will kill your ass. Well, thank you, Mike. What's the good news? And I'm going to tell you, the good news is really good news for me. He said, Steve, the good news is there's room for another hypocrite in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to tell you, that's as good a news for me today as it was then. It's as good a news for me to know that I can stand up here talking about a program that espouses perfect ideals but encourages me to aim for perfection and settle for patient improvement. It's good for me. You know, it might sound sometimes when we talk about our program of recovery, when we talk about ourselves, when we talk about our attempts to try to live this spiritual life, it may sound hypocritical to those on the outside looking in or sometimes to us talking with each other. But the fact of the matter is that I'm so glad to be able to be here and aim for perfection and be who I am at the same time. To do my best and know that my best does not have to be very good. It just has to be my best, honest, open, and willing attempt. I was able to move on from that just a little bit, begin to do some of the prayers, and just again, cracked a little bit of open-mindedness. But then I land, a few years later, found a way that I could connect with a higher power, with the God of my understanding. And I found it in our big book, and I found it in the chapter, We Agnostics. It's very simple for me, and I'm not selling it to anybody else. I'm just sharing with you what I found that connected me to you and me to that power. Where our book says that none of us can fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. I've grabbed hold of that. I spend no more time trying to define or comprehend that power. That has freed up some real time for me. It goes on to say that deep within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. In fact, in the final analysis, it is only there that the great reality may be found. So that is my last analysis. I am through analyzing that process about where God may be. I have decided for me that He is deep within me and that He is deep within you, and that has become my connection to the human race. Where I was disconnected before and felt different, that is now the connection to me and the rest of the world, is that I just adopt a position that God is deep within each of us. The book goes on to describe the fact that what I have to watch out for is that may be obscured. It may be obstructed by pomp, by worship of other things, and by calamity. And pomp is the reemergence of self, of pride and ego in me, of me taking back control of my life. I think that worship of other things or any of those things which I place above that relationship with God and above my relationship with you and my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that calamity can be real. It can be death, it can be sickness, it can be hard times, or it can be me getting home tonight and the cable being out on TV and me not being able to watch what I want. Because calamity is anything I have decided cannot be happening to me. And with Alcoholics Anonymous and through the process of these steps, I am open to more and more happening to me. I am not as needy as I used to be. I require less than I have ever required to be okay. The book talks about the fact that this is not about me having my demands met. This is a life about me lessening my demands. So it goes on to say that as I draw near to Him, He will disclose Himself to me. And that's what's happened to me here at Alcoholics Anonymous. As I draw near to you, he discloses himself to me. My friend Mo H. in Nashville, Mo passed away 3 years ago now. He died in December. My friend Jerry and I went to visit him in October of that year. We were sitting down, and Mo's a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's that guy that, you know, when that perennial slipper will come in your home group, and maybe not you, but I have to cop to the fact that every now and then, you know, I duck my head. I hope he didn't see me. Don't come over here. You know, I've been around that track with you 13 times. Don't come over here. Looked like Mo was running over to him, hugging him, saying, "Man, we love you. We're glad you're back." He's the type of man that makes me want to be a better man. He's the type of man that makes me proud to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever Mo talked, he would always share the line to a poem. And when he shared the line to this poem, it absolutely identified for me my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and my experience finding that power greater than myself here. We went to breakfast that morning when he was frail, and we knew it was probably going to be one of the last times we saw him. And in fact, he passed away 2 months later. And at breakfast, I said, "Mo, when I get the chance to go talk, would you mind if I ended my talks with the verse to that poem?" And, you know, he was a little embarrassed. He said, "Oh, Steve," he said, "if you think it'll help another drunk." And I said, "Oh, I know it will. I know it will every time, because I'll be there." And he said, "Then please do." I said, "Mo, it'll help me honor you, and it'll help me pass on what you've passed to me." And it's a simple little verse, but it says, "I sought my God I could not see. And I sought my soul eluded me. I sought my fellow man and found all three." And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. By seeking my fellow man, by me every now and then being able to step away from myself and offer myself to you. Through what I think from that, sometimes I make a burden out of it, and sometimes I do it with such gratitude I can't wait. But when I make myself available to you, I get what I needed all along. I become connected to the world. I become connected to that higher power, and I live with a purpose with which I never had before. Thank you, folks, so much for having me here this evening.